Republican Congressman Rodney Davis is running for his fourth term in office against Democratic challenger Betsy Dirksen Lonergan. Today, we sit down with Congressman Davis.
We've got to make sure that as we move forward in this country, that we change the tone and the incivility that has changed a lot since the last presidential election.
Plus, pumpkin spice season is officially upon us. We talk about the spice some people love, others love to hate. And we check in on this year's pumpkin crop with some Illinois farmers. And the Chicago International Film Festival has started, with titles from Hollywood to Iceland to Rwanda and everywhere in between.
It's a great chance to see movies you've heard about that are coming out commercially maybe a month or two later. It's also a great place to just take a chance on something you know nothing about.
That's the Chicago Tribune's film critic, Michael Phillips. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Representative Rodney Davis first took office in 2013 to represent Illinois' 13th congressional district. It covers many of central Illinois' biggest cities, including Champaign, Springfield, and Bloomington. Together, it's all a part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois. He's running for his fourth term, this time against Democratic challenger Betsy Dirksen Lonergan. We're working with her campaign to bring her on the 21st soon. A reminder that early voting has begun. The election is on November 6th. And Representative Davis is in studio with me now. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to be here with me in person.
Always great to be here, Nyla. I cannot believe it's the fourth term and 5.5 years. That's less than one Senate term, but that's what you get when you run for the House.
I was going to say, less than one Senate term. And last week was kind of a crazy one in Washington. So at least for those of us who are not there and seeing things from afar. So I'm not sure that many people noticed that some FEMA legislation you've been working on for years was signed into law last week, which I think is very relevant, especially as we're thinking about states like Florida right now as they recover or start to recover from Hurricane Michael. Why is this important for Illinois?
Well, first off, our thoughts and prayers go out to all the families who have been hit by this hurricane that gained strength as it came landward. We needed FEMA reforms, especially in states like Illinois, where rural communities were unfairly calculated in with our largest communities, and Illinois then would not get federal assistance for rebuilding public infrastructure. This isn't something that I talked to constituents about when I first ran that we wanted to fix. And the folks in Gifford, they know full well what it was like to have to recover themselves while other communities in other states were getting some public assistance from the federal government. We now pass this law, a bipartisan way, that's going to make sure FEMA takes into consideration when calculating disaster assistance to states like Illinois. It takes into consideration localized impacts. It's a huge step. And I'm just glad that we were able to get good bipartisan support to move this. I want to personally thank Senator Duckworth and her team over in the Senate for helping us do so.
You've called for legislation to protect Dreamers. Those are the young people who were brought to this country illegally as children as part of a broader overhaul of immigration reform. And we've seen the effects of the lack of comprehensive immigration reform, I think, especially over the past year. If we look at the administration's policy of separating children from their families at the border. If reelected, can you give me three things you can commit to voting on for immigration reform?
Well, I'll just give you what I already have voted on. The sheer fact is we voted on two immigration reform bills in the month of July. The last one was one I preferred, and it actually provided a path to legal status for all Dreamers and DACA kids. It also it legislated that no administration ever could separate children and families at the border. It also provided funding, not just authorization, to begin building a structure along parts of the southern border that need it. And there are parts of the southern border that it's less about immigration and illegal immigration, and it's more about the drugs that are coming up from the Mexican border through our states and into our rural communities that are ravaging our communities. So we have to have a border wall in certain areas of our southern border. And then lastly, the fourth point was we actually reformed our immigration system. My office here in Champaign takes so many cases from people who are here working through the legal immigration process. And one of the best events you could ever go to is a naturalization ceremony. It's people who have worked through the legal process to raise their right hand and become Americans. That process is too long, it's too costly, and it needed to be fixed. We did that. All these provisions were touted by Republicans and Democrats. We got zero Democrat votes on the bill and not enough Republicans. Had over 112 Republicans vote for it. And that just goes to show you, Nyla, this issue has been hijacked by the far right and the far left. They don't want to solve the problem because they want to just use this as a campaign issue, but it affects too many people's lives to put up with this just for political reasons.
I want to talk to you about some other issues that have, in terms to your point about things that need to be fixed, I want to ask you about health care.
Sure.
You've stressed recently that you want to reduce costs and protect people with pre-existing conditions. Insurers have said the uncertainty around the Affordable Care Act is part of what's driving higher costs. And Republican efforts to repeal the ACA, which you have voted in favor of, would give states more flexibility and expand short-term plans, which would reduce some pre-existing condition protections. So what are you doing to make sure that those protections remain?
Well, we voted on that. The American Health Care Act that I supported was projected to lower costs for consumers that were in that individual market, lower costs for consumers that were in the employer-based market, and have layers upon layers of protections for pre-existing conditions. We can create a healthcare system in this country that's affordable and covers those who have been afflicted with a disease, like my wife is a 19-year colon cancer survivor, that have never asked for that. And it's offensive to me, as a husband of a cancer survivor, that anybody would accuse me of trying to get rid of pre-existing condition coverage. Now, the insurers you bring up, it's funny that they're worried about the uncertainty of the Obamacare exchanges when they raised their prices 108% when Obamacare was nothing but a certainty. And as a matter of fact, during this uncertainty that they're talking about, the prices on the exchange, which covers about in the non-Medicaid expansion portion, the exchange in my district covers about 14,000 people. And those prices are actually set to stabilize or go down in many counties, but we don't have choices. Many counties have one, maybe two choices at most, and we still have way too many people that were promised that they could keep their health care, they could keep their doctor, and it would be affordable. They're having to pay upwards of $24,000 a year in premiums and deductibles before they get $1 of coverage. And I will tell you, I was stopped at a parade in Hillsborough in August by a former county elected official and his wife. His wife's a colon cancer survivor too, Nyla. And if she gets diagnosed again, they have to reach that threshold of $24,000 before her pre-existing condition gets covered under Obamacare right now. We've got to do something to help them not only have that coverage, but be able to afford to use it. And right now, 60 million people in this country still don't have insurance, didn't have insurance when we passed the American Health Care Act, or couldn't afford to use the insurance coverage they had. That is not what the American people were promised. And now you see even folks like Senator Durbin, who gave us Obamacare, and even President Obama, who stood right here in Champaign, Illinois, just a few weeks ago, where I sat about 15 feet in front of him, they have gone beyond Obamacare. They've gone beyond the Affordable Care Act. They're now pushing for a complete government takeover in what they call Medicare for All.
And so what would you, you said a couple of things there that I just want to go back to. I want to go back to the whole idea, because it's really hard to separate all of these things. The pre-existing condition, Senator Sanders, Medicare for All plan, which is, I assume, what you were just referencing there. The problem is that the system, I think everyone agrees the system needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And so how would you suggest that that go about happening?
Well, we did pass a fix. It's called the American Health Care Act. We were one vote away in the Senate from actually moving good policy forward that would have provided layers upon layers of protection for pre-existing conditions. I sat in a small room with many of my colleagues, the vice president, many in the administration, to hash out what our priorities were. And our priorities were to provide that pre-existing condition coverage. And we had that in the bill that we passed. So what we have to do is we've got to make sure that many people in my district, about half, get their health care through their employer. Leaving the Affordable Care Act as is means that the taxes that are going to be implemented that we have fought from being implemented, like the Cadillac tax, if you support the Affordable Care Act, you support that Cadillac tax being implemented, which will force employers to charge more for their coverage and offer less benefits. That's not what anyone in this country was promised when the Affordable Care Act was passed. And I think we now know why, because many folks, including the two that I just mentioned, they want to move to more of a government-run system. Look, I love the folks at the VA. They do a great job over in Danville, but they also don't provide the service that we expect to even the 14,000 veterans that rely upon the VA to get their service here in my district. And we have way too many cases where veterans are calling me as their congressman to try and get them a doctor's appointment at a VA clinic or at a facility. I don't think that's going to be indicative of success if we let the government take over what decisions should be made between you and your doctor.
I want to ask you about the Farm Bill. You were on the Agricultural Committee. The Farm Bill expired on October 1st. With Republicans having a majority in the House and the Senate, why not extend the bill or pass the stopgap?
Well, because no Farm Bill extension's ever been passed before a December or January. Remember, the farm programs in the Farm Bill are based upon crop year, not the federal fiscal year. No farmer who's listening to this show is going to see a change in their ARC program, their PLC program, or crop insurance. The programs, ironically, that we're working with USDA to shore up because they're not what we call baseline programs are usually programs that Democrats are known to support even more than some of my fellow Republicans, even though I'm supportive of these programs with my Democrat colleagues. It's the organic research program. It's farmers market advocacy programs, it's conservation programs. These are the ones that we'll now trust that Sonny Perdue and the Trump administration will help us get those programs through this temporary delay. I think we should come up with a Farm Bill compromise. That's why I'm on the conference committee. I saw it work 4.5 years ago in a very bipartisan way. This time, the bill became very partisan, even in committee. We had zero Democrats voting for the bill that included many of their priorities, and they didn't even offer a single amendment. I went to Washington to legislate. I even offered amendments as a Republican member of the committee, and I helped draft the bill because I didn't like some of the provisions that made it into the final bill. My amendments passed unanimously. You can't complain about the legislative process when you have a seat at the table and you don't offer any solutions to the legislative process. And that's why we're at the point where we are with the Farm Bill. I would go back any day to Washington if we can come up with an agreement. I would even go back on Election Day to vote to pass this Farm Bill.
I want to ask you about tax cuts as well, because you recently also introduced a bill to make last year's federal tax cuts permanent. Those have been criticized for giving far more money to wealthy people and to corporations than to middle and lower income people, and it adds to the federal deficit. I see you shaking your head, but I'm just going to point out that the Congressional Budget Office said that the cuts won't generate enough economic growth to pay for themselves over the next decade. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office. So why double down on this?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office actually has estimated that our tax cut bill has paid for about 88% of what they said the cost was going to be right now. So they've readjusted their figures. And as a matter of fact,
88%, but not 100.
Well, we're only 1 year in. That's pretty good because of economic growth. The economic growth, tax revenues coming in are over $1.2 trillion. That's 88% of what they projected a deficit would be. So they're coming back, they're readjusting their numbers. But I introduced the bill to make the individual rates permanent. When that bill left the House of Representatives and went to the Senate, the individual rates and the corporate rates were made permanent. When it came back from the Senate, the individual rates that our families are enjoying a higher percentage, middle-class families in my district are enjoying about a $2,000 tax cut that's more money in their family budget. And their tax liability is a lot less as a percentage than any high-income earner. So when you look at these tax cuts, I want to make them permanent for families just like they were for corporations when they came back from the Senate. And even many Democrats in the Senate used this as a reason why they voted against the tax cut bill in the first place. And Bernie Sanders is one. Many Democrats have said that, boy, I wish those individual rates would have been permanent and maybe they would have voted for the bill. Now's their chance to actually put their rhetoric and their vote where their rhetoric is. It's only fair, as we're seeing historic economic growth, historic unemployment, to make sure that we make permanent the lower tax rates that have given middle-class families all throughout this country, and especially in my district, an extra $2,000 to spend on what they want.
I want to ask you about the you talk a lot about, and I know this is really important to you, you've talked a lot about the need for bipartisan cooperation and toning down partisan rhetoric. And I wanted to ask you about the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Were you surprised at the partisan attacks he made against Democrats during his confirmation process?
Well, I'm surprised at the whole process. If this is the new normal in Supreme Court nominees, we as Republicans and Democrats and as Americans need to take a step back and reassess the process.
What about what he said, though? Separating what politicians said.
You can't separate what he said without adding in what many of the senators were saying, too. So the process itself led to what Justice Kavanaugh said during his confirmation hearings, and also some of the things that I was surprised to hear out of some of the senators that I walk the halls of the Capitol with. It's a frustrating process that has to change. Anyone who's accused needs to be heard. Anyone who is who is the accuser needs to be heard. And both were heard. But we've got to make sure that as we move forward in this country, that we change the tone and the incivility that has changed a lot since the last presidential election.
And to that point, when we think about the deep divisions, especially for people on the ends of the political spectrum, I want to ask you on behalf of all of the people in the middle, and we're almost out of time here, so if I could just get a yes or no, do you think as a country we're better off now than we were 2 years ago?
Economically, yes. Rhetorically and civility-wise, no.
That's Congressman Rodney Davis. He's again running for office again for another term. By the way, if you have questions you would like to ask him, you can submit them for a debate that he is going to be doing with us next week between Congressman Davis and Betsy Dirksen Londrigan. You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Representative, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on again.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Professor James Anderson, Citizenship, Immigration, and National Identity, Civic Education on the Sesquicentennial Anniversary of the 14th Amendment, Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. With the leaves beginning to fall and our first 35-degree day just around the corner here in Urbana, we wanted to give you a little taste of the season. And what's more quintessentially fall than pumpkins? Especially here in Illinois, where we grow more pumpkins than any other state, so we thought we'd check in on this year's pumpkin crop with some of our local farmers. John Ackerman is on the line with me now. He and his wife Eve own Ackerman Family Farm in Morton, just south of Peoria, where they farm about 300 acres. Lynn Rader and his sons own Rader Family Farms in Normal. They've got about 2,400 acres. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
John, let me start with you. With that weather forecast, are you a little bit worried about frost, how that might affect the pumpkins?
Well, every year we get a little concerned. Generally, that first light frost doesn't do much damage, but a lot of times it'll make the leaves drop on the pumpkins, and that kind of takes away the blanket they have out there. By the time a second or third frost comes around, it can be a problem. What we really worry about is a hard freeze when it gets down to like 28 degrees. That can do some damage.
So, Lynn, we haven't been anywhere near that, obviously. I wonder, we've had some kind of crazy temperature fluctuations when it goes from, I'm just thinking about the temperatures this week. I think we were 86 in Urbana this week and then down to 35. Does that make a difference to pumpkins?
Yeah, I mean, it affects everything. You know, heat is probably the worst thing for pumpkins. They get sunburned and it spoils earlier. So the heat this summer was overwhelming and, you know, it caused a lot of damage I'm finding now just because it was too hot. But yeah, like John said, if we get below 30, we're concerned about the hard freeze.
And Lynn, to the point about heat damaging the pumpkins, as you said, as you're seeing it now, what does that happen? Are they just not as big? Are they drier? What is the worry?
Well, it comes when you your leaves maybe from fungus side or fungus summit showing up in your plants and your health of the plant you do lose leaves along the way. And so I think when the pumpkins are exposed to the sun and you get 90 plus degrees, it seems like it has a way of sunburning the pumpkins, and then that causes spoilage there from all that heat.
John, what do you think is ideal pumpkin growing weather for you all?
You know, it tends to be really good for pumpkins is relatively dry weather throughout the season. The pumpkins are a low-growing plant with large leaves. They're subject to disease and funguses. They're kind of a fickle plant, to be honest. So when it's relatively dry, they do quite well. And they make a pretty good mix for kind of diversifying our crops. The row crops like corn and beans tend to like a lot of water, whereas maybe in a dry year, you'll do better with your pumpkins.
And so that said, I know a couple of years ago when it was very wet, it was a really tough year. John, what is this year looking like for you guys?
This has been a very, very good year growing-wise. We had a few of the same problems that Lynn did. When it got so hot in early September especially, we had a few varieties that got sunburned. But in general, it's been a great production year for us. Problem with the heat is in September, it not only hurts your production, but it kind of brings down your sales a bit too, because people aren't as willing to come out when it doesn't feel like fall.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's been really good though. The weather's been terrific and they're really making up for lost time.
And Lynn, what does your crop look like this year?
Well, we started out pretty good and we have the good dry weather and the heat combination speeds up the growth. And so it seemed like it was moving right along. But then once we got further along, it seemed like that even as we sprayed and everything else, we thought we would head off most diseases, but we still probably had some damage, and then that affected some of the quality. So we're finding enough out there, but it's just like it takes some extra just to make sure you have enough. So we've been around 30 acres and find that that's probably works best for us.
Mm. John, how many different varieties of pumpkin are you growing?
We've got 160 different varieties of pumpkins, gourds, and squash out here. So we're trying to provide just the unusual things that's hard to find in other places. We get to seed for those varieties just from all over the world, every continent except Antarctica.
Do you have a big retail operation of people coming to the farm as well, John?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, for our ornamental pumpkins and squash, we don't wholesale those. We just sell everything here at the farm. We're a smaller farm, very much a family farm. But with the things that we grow here, we sell right here on the farm.
And do you ever sell, John, do you sell to Libby's as well? Because I think a lot of people don't realize a lot of the canned pumpkin that people buy all across the country comes from here in Illinois.
Yes, every year we grow our ornamental pumpkins for our own customers. But on some years, I get the contract with the local Libby's plant, and then I'll grow those processing or canning pumpkins. I didn't happen to have a contract this year, though.
What about you, Lynn?
Yeah, I've raised Libby pumpkins in the past. Wasn't this year, but yeah, I've been able to be a part of that group that supply Libby's.
And is that something that you guys normally would want to do? I don't know if it's more profitable or less profitable to do something like having a contract with Libby's, John?
Well, it's been great working with the local Libby's plant. They've been very good to us producers. And I think when they offer us a contract, they try to set the price to make it enticing. Make it a good deal for us to go ahead and sign up with them. So I've very much enjoyed working with them. They've helped us out in those years where it's been too wet to actually be able to harvest. Generally, when they offer a contract, I very much like to accept it.
John, I know your family has been farming for more than 100 years, right?
The farm that we're on, that we live on, we've had for exactly 109 years and 2 days.
Wow. Why do you think how did pumpkins become such a big crop for Illinois?
Well, there's a series of reasons. There's an area across the country they call the Orange Belt, where it's not so far south that they have too many diseases, but it's not so far north that the season's too short. Along with that, we're blessed with incredible soils. And we've got a lot of farmers who have a great deal of knowledge and experience in growing these specialty crops. Being as there's been the processing plant here in the area, it just makes a great mix for Illinois being the number one state for pumpkins.
Lynn, how about you? How long has your family been farming?
I'm on the farm that was started in 75 years ago.
Mm. And what is this time of year like for you guys? If you're as pumpkin farmers, is October pretty busy?
Very busy. It's daylight till dark every day, except when we're open, but when off season, we're still working long days and trying to be ready and get everything done and completed by the time we're ready to open up. But it's been a real busy summer and a hot one to be out in it. But we were scrambling to get done, get ready.
And Johnny, you guys are ready and open as well, right?
We are. We also have some agritainment. We've got our corn maze. We have animals to see. We do hayrack rides. I think Lynn was being generous when he said he works sunrise to sunset, because I know he works way past sunset a lot of days.
I appreciate both of you gentlemen taking the time to speak with us, because I know this is the busiest season for you. John Ackerman is the owner of Ackerman Family Farm in Morton. Lynn Rader, Rader Family Farms in Normal. Thank you guys both for being with me. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about pumpkins and our state's claim to all that pumpkin production, but if you're not in Morton, in fact, really, no matter where you are in the U.S., if you take a big whiff right now, what are you likely to smell? Yeah, pumpkin spice. It's everywhere. In your lattes, in your cookies, even in your beer, in your butter. Whether or not you love pumpkin spice, we thought we'd give you some alternatives for this time of year, because there are certainly no shortage of other spices to choose from. Just ask Patty Erd, owner of the Spice House and longtime purveyor of all things spicy in Chicago and Evanston for 60 years. Patty joined us on the line, and we started by asking her if she's a pumpkin spice fan.
I feel it's a little bit, I feel sad for pumpkin pie spice, because it's been horribly maligned, and it's really good on its own for what it's meant to do. But I kind of feel like there was a scene with the men from Mad Men all sitting around the boardroom going, well, it's delicious, it smells good, and what? It's an aphrodisiac. Let's put it everywhere.
I'm in your camp. Right. I'm in the camp of, I love pumpkin pie, and I think it's great in there. Perhaps we should define what pumpkin spice actually is. Is it just the spices that you put in pumpkin pie?
It's just the spices. So you have in our blend, we have a very nice Chinese cinnamon. We have allspice, ground nutmeg, ginger, mace, and some cloves. And anything that is called pumpkin anything, pretty much, it's about the spices. There's no pumpkin really anywhere.
Right.
It goes into the pumpkin pie.
All of those things sound great for pumpkin pie. I think maybe people will love them in their coffee. But I wonder, maybe when we use it in the right foods in the right amounts, it can be really good. So apart from pumpkin pie, do you have suggestions of where or how one could use pumpkin spice?
You're seeing it used everywhere, but I think there's a couple other blends that we have that maybe are the understudies for pumpkin pie, and they're waiting for their 15 seconds of fame. But one of our classic favorites is one that we call cake spice. And
What's in that?
It's a similar blend. So it has cinnamon, but it's got a little bit more cinnamon. It's got star anise, powdered cloves, nutmeg, allspice, and ginger. So it has a little bit more nutmeg and cloves. It doesn't have allspice, but it's just a really nice traditional English baking spice blend. And when we look at the history and when people immigrated to America, I'm always super surprised that in cake recipes you will see these ingredients like nutmeg and cloves, which are incredibly expensive right now and must have been extremely, extremely dear to people that were first coming in this country. I mean, they might have brought them back from Germany or England with them. And so cake spice kind of just became the generic term for what spices that you might have on hand that would go good in a cake.
Right.
But we recently had Bon Appetit had a recipe for banana bread oatmeal that used cake spice, so it did get its brief second in the,
okay,
in the spotlight.
But well, those are lovely.
It's a really,
yeah,
nice mixture.
And it's like a traditional, and that makes sense, because that goes into like what would go into a traditional spice cake, which is a nice alternative,
yeah,
to thinking about
spice cake, right, or spice cookies or spice streusel. If you see many different spice ingredients, you would just replace that some amount with a cake spice.
As far away from pumpkin spice as you can get, I know you recommend Chinese five spice. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, that's a really nice blend. And again, you're talking about kind of the same spices. You've got a lot of cinnamon, but in here we're adding powdered star anise and also aniseed, ginger, and cloves. And the star anise is just it's a very hard to describe in word flavor. It's just a sort of an elusive flavor, lightly of licorice, but maybe a little more intensely sweet. And some five-place recipes will have Sichuan peppercorns in it, too. Ours does not, because when we created it back in the 70s, Sichuan peppercorns were actually banned in this country. They didn't enforce the ban until later on in the 90s. In fact, we had the FDA come in with their guns and confiscate our Sichuan peppercorns.
Is that real? Is that a real story?
Yeah, it's a real story. But
wow.
They had a spore on it that could interfere with citrus. So they were very, very worried about Sichuan peppercorns destroying all the citrus crops in California. And so they, you know, that was a very big concern. And in the big picture, probably we'd rather have citrus than Sichuan peppercorns. So we didn't have that in there all along. And we want to be consistent for our customers. So we could probably make another version now of the Chinese dry spice powder that had those peppercorns in it. But ours doesn't have that in traditionally. But it's a very, very nice alternative, really, for anywhere you might try pumpkin pie spice.
And where would, so you would use, that would be for meat? You'd use Chinese five spice as a rub for meat?
You can use it in, if you're doing a variation on, say, a chicken salad and wonton noodles, you'll see it. It's really great on Chinese spare ribs, pork satay. And if you mix it with honey and soy sauce and maybe, say, a little orange juice, it makes just a wonderful marinade or a dipping sauce.
And then there was something else that you wanted to recommend to us as another alternative called Grains of Paradise. What's that?
Well, Grains of Paradise is a little bit different. I don't know that I would say alternative, but it's just this it's this amazing spice that's only been found in it's been in West Africa for a long time, but it's only recently come to the United States. So we had it not long ago when people started hearing this commercial about I can't remember which beer it was, but the man said, I get to go to exotic places around the world and discover amazing ingredients like Grains of Paradise. So people kept hearing this and calling up and saying, do you have Grains of Paradise? And we kept saying, well, are you making craft beer? And they said, no, it just sounds so good. We just want something that's called Grains of Paradise. But basically, this is a very good a marketing strategy from spice traders in the Middle Ages who wanted to, you know, have a great price. So they said that these were peppercorns that grew only in Eden, and they were collected as they floated down the rivers of paradise. And that's how they got that name. But they might not be grains of paradise, but they're really, really delicious. So they have kind of a peppery flavor, a little bit of cardamom to them. You can say a little bit of flavors reminiscent of hazelnut, butter, citrus. It's nutty. It's got a lot going on.
Patty, we have less than a minute left, but I just want to ask you about cinnamon, because everyone thinks they know about cinnamon, but there's so many different kinds. Can you really quickly just give us a breakdown on how they're not all cinnamons are created equal?
Yes, everywhere cinnamon grows, it's just like grapes. There's terroir, and the different climates will produce different results, whether there's a lot of rainfall or volcanic ash. We have cassia from China, Indonesia. We have a true cinnamon from Sri Lanka, and they are very, very different tasting, different flavors, even though they're all cinnamon. And we encourage people to come in and taste, because that is absolutely the best way to do the comparison.
That's Patty Erd, the owner of the Spice House in Evanston in Chicago. She joined us to recommend some other spices and spice blends for the fall. Coming up after the break, the Chicago International Film Festival just started, with titles from Hollywood to Iceland to Rwanda and everywhere in between. We'll tell you what not to miss and what you can catch even if you're not in Chicago. That's coming up next. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. An endangered roller rink, a Kenyan convenience store in 19th century Manchester, England. Those are just some of the places you can visit from the comfort of a movie theater during this upcoming Chicago International Film Festival. It's almost 2 weeks of movies from around the world during what is the 54th year of the festival. And with so many titles, it can be a little overwhelming, whether you're a film buff or a casual fan. Luckily, we have Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips here with me in our studios in Urbana. Hey, Michael, welcome back to
The
21st.
How are you? Good.
So this is a 54th year. How many years have you been going to this?
54. No, not quite. No, this is about my 12th year.
And so this is presented by the nonprofit Cinema Chicago. How would you describe the mission of this festival when you're thinking about, I think people think of, when people say film festival, people think of Tribeca or Sundance or things like that.
Right. Or maybe they've seen images of the huge international festivals like Cannes, which is all about George Clooney and Catherine Deneuve on the red carpet and all that. There is red carpet here, but it's more sparingly kind of rolled out. And there are some good
it's
people.
It's a Chicago version.
Well, and there's some good people coming. I got Carey Mulligan in a new film called Wildlife. I think she's one of our best actresses right now. And, you know, various directors are coming in. I guess the one thing you can say about the Chicago International Film Festival is it's the best clearinghouse for this sort of array of international and American work you can find in the Midwest. It's 120-some titles for features. It's actually 3 days shorter this year than it was in other years, and I actually think that's good. I think 12 days is the right length. 15 felt like you
it's
were...
It's a little... People get fatigued.
It felt like an internship at that point, you know, 15 days. So it's a great chance to see movies you've heard about that are coming out commercially maybe a month or two later. It's also a great place to just take a chance on something you know nothing about. The film from Iceland, the film from Slovenia, whatever. Maybe it's a film on a subject you find interesting, like the roller rink scene on the south side of Chicago in the 70s. There's all kinds of things where you might just follow your tastes a little bit and try what's happening in Theater 6.
Let's talk about some of the titles you're excited about. Roma is one that I think is going to get a lot of attention, directed by Oscar winner Alfonso Cuarón, who did Gravity and Y Tu Mamá También.
Right.
This one, we're back in Mexico. We're not in outer space.
No, that's right. This is great. I've seen this already at the Toronto Festival, and it's a gorgeous widescreen experience. It's shot in black and white, and it's just a series of memories that Cuarón put together in the shape of a story of his own adolescence in Mexico City at the time his parents were breaking up. And it's just kind of a reprocessing of his life back then. And it's just exquisitely done. It's not a conventional heart tugger, I would say, but it's dealing with childhood and family issues and Mexican history that may be news to some people in America. There's just all kinds of things roiling around in this really wonderful coming-of-age piece. And it's focused especially on the women in Cuarón's life, the housekeeper who essentially raised him, as well as his birth mother. And you get a great sense of all these different family dynamics. It's one of the best things I've seen this year.
So, Michael, The Hate U Give is also an adaptation of a young adult novel. That seems to be kind of fertile ground these days, to take a YA novel that maybe was a hit or not and make it into a film. Is this one unique?
Really good. Well, for one thing, it's got the advantage of not being about some sort of dystopian post-apocalyptic world. You know, so it's a nice change.
Nobody's dying. No one has a terminal illness.
Well, people are dying.
I feel like those are the two. We normally have dystopian or someone is dying.
This is a great piece. And in fact, our daughter, who's now going into seventh grade, just read it for school. And it's just a really splendid film adaptation of a story of an African-American high school senior who lives in a working-class black neighborhood in Atlanta, and she goes to school in this very Tony, kind of mostly white prep school. And it's a really relatable story for anybody who deals with kind of the problem and the challenge of negotiating two different worlds in their lives. And, you know...
We actually have a clip of it.
Oh, great.
So let's listen to a bit of it.
Trying to make some sense out of it.
It's thug life. The hate you give little infants.
F's everybody. I know what it stands for. What do you think it means?
I think it's about us.
Us who?
Black people. Poor people, everybody at the bottom.
Right, you want it? Pac was trying to school us on how the system's designed against us. Why else you think so many people in our neighborhood deal?
They need the money.
Yeah. And they no real jobs around here. So they fall into the trap.
That's from The Hate U Give. We're talking about the Chicago International Film Festival, which takes place October 10th through the 21st with Michael Phillips, the Chicago Tribune's film critic. So that's an interesting, it gives you kind of a sense of the pace. It is not, when you described it, that was not the pace of what I thought it was
well,
going
that's
to be.
Well, that's a
slower.
That's a contemplative moment
right.
between the father and the daughter. And the father's kind of an old revolutionary, like a Black Panther alum almost. And, you know, he comes from a very kind of progressive firebrand background. And his daughter is... you know, take some of that as wisdom and take some of that with a grain of salt. So it's this is a great, refreshing YA film in that it doesn't give the parent characters or the children in this story, which involves a, you know, a white cop shooting a black teenager. It involves a lot of stuff that is just smack right in the news. And, you know, the clip we just heard, I mean, those are issues that they're distressingly pertinent today. So this is just a really well-acted adaptation of a good, strong story that I would take anybody over the age of 15 to.
Okay, good.
Yep.
One that's also getting a lot of buzz, not just on the festival circuit, but in mainstream channels as well, is Widows. Mm. And this is, we have our Illinois connection. This is Chicago and Gillian Flynn, and it takes place in Chicago, starring Viola Davis.
Yep.
Let's hear a little clip of this.
We got to start thinking like professionals. We're in business together. There's not going to be some cozy reunion. After this job, we're done. We have 3 days to look and move like a team of men. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
Why?
Because no one thinks we have the balls to pull this off.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
I'm sorry. I'm offended by that language. I can't go on with this segment.
Stop. Walk out.
Man, this is a really juicy crime thriller. This is based on an old British TV miniseries from the 80s, and it's about this group of women who are the widows of these criminals, these London criminals in the old version, who get killed in this robbery attempt, and the widows have to deal with the mafia that are demanding the money that has somehow disappeared in this sort of messed up robbery. Anyway, it moved the whole story to Chicago. Gillian Flynn, who was just represented on HBO by Sharp Objects, and course,
Gone Girl. Gone Girl.
And you know, she co-wrote it with the director, Steve McQueen. This is his first film since 12 Years a Slave. And it's totally different genre. I mean, we're talking about just sort of low-down pulp thriller with Colin Farrell and Robert Duvall playing two of the meanest, most manipulative, most corrupt aldermen in Chicago. And if you're worried about Chicago's image problem or sensitivities about, this is not the movie for you. This gives Chicago three more black eyes than any other film lately. But it's also terrific fun and just really gripping and a couple of great twists. I'm a big fan.
There's also an emphasis on international comedy. We're going through all the different genres here, but I wonder how much of that is a challenge to translate humor from a country and language to another?
Yeah, good point. That's a lot of comedies have difficulty traveling, and that includes a lot of American comedies that go overseas where you have huge hits here, and you just don't know if the humor or the world is going to translate easily. But I think it's a great thing to kind of section off because it tends to put the emphasis on a more visual comedy in some ways, but also it's a great way to see what's on the minds of filmmakers in other parts of the world because there's a lot of good social satirists working in every language.
And that's what I was going to ask you about because I think we're used to international humor that's British or Australian, mm-hmm. but I think this is probably a great opportunity for us to branch out to something else.
There's a great, and I haven't seen it myself, but the new artistic director of the festival, Mimi Plauchet, is very strong on this film from Cuba called The Extraordinary Journey of Celeste Garcia, and it's this absurdist send-up, as it says in the program notes, of contemporary Cuban society. It takes place in a world where the government just simply announces to the Cuban people that aliens from outer space have been living unbeknownst among all the Cuban citizenry all over the neighborhoods. And it's just basically what happens to these neighborhoods after this news comes out and people realize that they've had aliens living next door. And it's kind of a political allegory for all kinds of things. And I hear it's really funny. So, yeah, well, I'll find out, you know, just like like everybody else.
That sounds great. The festival is also paying tribute, Michael, to Chicago native William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist. So there's a documentary about him. Let's hear a little clip of that.
At the time I directed the film, The Exorcist, I had never seen the real thing. But on May 1st, 2016, Father Gabriella Amort, the Vatican exorcist, invited me to witness an actual exorcism. I had no idea what to expect.
Well, even the music.
Very close to the old.
I was going
to
say, that sounds like we're in the Exorcist.
Tubular bell stuff from right. From 1973. Yeah. Friedkin's a great character. He's a real raconteur and a wonderful storyteller. And I haven't seen the documentary on his life and career that we just heard from, but I've seen all kinds of his films. They let him pick one great old Hollywood film that he wanted to showcase and talk about in kind of a masterclass setting. And he picked one of my favorite MGM musicals, Fred Astaire, Sid Charisse, called The Bandwagon. So I love that this guy who's known for The Exorcist and French Connection and these incredibly rough, gritty, really tough crime dramas and supernatural thrillers picked an MGM musical as one of his favorites.
What other documentaries are out there that you think people might want to check out?
The two I'm most eager to see that I have not yet seen are United Skates, which is a tribute to roller skating in the African-American community, particularly in Chicago. And there's a film by Charles Ferguson called Watergate about, it's 4 hours, I think. But it's
4 hours about Watergate?
Look, I think it's a good time. I wouldn't recommend a four-hour film on Watergate blind, but this filmmaker made one of the great documentaries and really the only truly essential one on the Iraq war called No End in Sight, and it's the one documentary that nobody on the right could possibly poke one factual hole in. It's so meticulously researched, and I think Watergate promises to be the same thing. It's a good time, I think, to look back at a major political scandal at a time when a lot of us are worrying if we're paying close enough attention to some of the scandals in the making right now.
You mentioned there's a new artistic director. I just wanted to end by asking you about that, a change for the festival this year.
It is. Mimi Plauchet has been a member of the staff of the festival for 12, 13 years now in various capacities, mostly as a programmer. And she, to nobody's surprise, finally took over the reins of the longtime founder and artistic director, Michael Kutza. Now, he ran the festival for over 50 years, which is kind of remarkable. And the festival itself is the longest-running juried film festival in North America. I mean, so that's kind of remarkable. It's also, I think, a great time for a change. And Mimi's tastes, we'll see what they really develop into. But this is the first full year where they're reflected. And I hope she's off to a good start. I can't wait to see it.
So that is the 54th Chicago International Film Festival. I want to thank Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips for giving us a little tour of where we should go.
You bet. And we should say, too, that if you go to the film festival, and you should, it's at the downtown Chicago AMC River East 21-screen theater right down there in Streeterville, and it's near all kinds of bars and restaurants. It's a good place for it.
Thanks, Michael. That's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.